accession number 26560, Reel 3.
Mr. Nicol, Reel 3. Now, I'm talking about the period when you were at Bury St. Edmunds, it ran about April, May 1951.
Right.
And you're fundamentally, you're just waiting for a posting.
We were actually waiting, I think, for the battalion, the first battalion of the Royal Norfolks to come back from Germany. So we were sort of waiting, really, in the transit camp. In charge of us was an old sergeant who was more or less coming up for retirement, who taught us how to have kit inspections.
Well, tell us about it, because you said you're on daily kit inspections. What was it like?
He'd explained, he was very good, at the sort of standards you had to have for a kit inspection. We'd never had this before. How you scrubbed everything white, if it should be white, and you scraped your brushes if they should be white and stuff like this. He showed us how to lay out on the bed or on our beds, and we had to then work on our kit, and I suppose it was for us something to do, really, and then lay it out in their beds each day, and really, once you got the kit up to scratch, it was a matter of getting up, making your bed, and just laying your kit out, and that was it, you know. An officer did come round and inspect the kit inspection, if you like, you know, and did the kit inspection, and we learnt great things about if you were sort of short of a brush, you borrowed it from someone else and then you threw it across the room when the officer had gone by and stuff like this. So this actually went on, which was quite funny at the time. He taught us quite a lot, this old sergeant. He taught us how to pack a valise for a start. You know, you don't just sort of stuff things in. He taught us that if you folded everything to the perfect width of the of your kit bag or your valise, how much more you could get in. And he was very patient. He used to take us on drill parades. He'd make a little bit of a competition out of it. He'd say, you know, the Suffolks against the Norfolks and stuff like this, you know. And that was quite enjoyable. The food was quite good at Bury because it was a smaller camp. We were given quite a lot of freedom at night and weekends. We could sort of come home.
What would you sort of would do in the evening? I mean, when you went out, would you go into Bury St. Edmunds?
Well, yes, and you'd sort of wander around, and if you got any money, you'd perhaps have a drink or something to eat, and generally look around the place, you know.
And how did you get on with the civilians there? I mean, how did they cope with all these young lads?
Well, in Colchester and Bury St. Edmunds, they were both sort of garrison towns. They virtually ignored us, to be honest. They weren't particularly friendly, and they treated you as though you weren't there. That was the impression I got at the time. You know.
And there was no trouble with young lads or...
No, I never came up with any trouble like that, you know. Trouble with other regiments, because there were other regiments in different barracks around Colchester. I mean, it was very much a garrison town. There'd be rivalry perhaps between regiments and people would fall out. But apart from that, no. I never did come into contact with a lot of trouble like that.
And so how long were you there? You don't know,
well,
really.
Bury. Only a few weeks, I would guess. And then we were shipped off to the battalion, which was at Dover Castle.
And this is the 1st Battalion Royal Norfolk Regiment.
That's right.
And do you know what month you arrived there? We can look it up, actually, Will.
No, I don't really know.
We'll look it up.
I'm sort of roughly... We went September...
You were at Dover and then I think Crowborough.
That's right, yeah. It would be around perhaps June, but I'm not ever so sure about that. We joined the battalion, and we were sort of given companies, if you like. You know, U10 will go to A company, U10 to B company, and so on.
And what was yours?
S company.
Support company. Mm-hmm.
And
now, which platoon within support company?
Well, we were interviewed then, and the officer who interviewed me was Captain Haycroft. Haycroft. And he was the captain of the MMG platoon, the machine gun platoon. And he asked sort of a few questions, and then it was up to him whether he accepted you into his platoon.
Now, what sort of questions was he asking?
What have you done in your life? You know, what do you want to do? And really, it was sort of just a surface sort of thing, you know. I think he just wanted to talk to you and get an impression, you know.
Now, you'd had no training up to then on the Vickers, had you?
Oh, no, none at all.
Just the Bren?
Just the Bren, that's right.
And were you accepted for the...
Yes, I was accepted. And
were you pleased?
Bewildered, I think. I don't think I realised or understood, really, the difference between support company and... the rifle companies, only vaguely, you know. I mean, I could have been in the anti-tank platoon, the MMGs or the mortars, you know. And I got the MMGs.
That's medium machine gun?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, what was the composition of the platoon?
Three sections, run by usually a captain. Three section sergeants, and then downward from there there'd be number ones, which would be corporals, range takers, who would be corporals, and then you had number twos and number threes on the gun, you know, and then you'd have some sort of auxiliary, brain gunner, radio operators. That was about it, you know. And then we had training.
Now, we're very interested in the training of the Vickers. I mean, how did they go about? Because they'd have to do it fairly sharpish. But
oh, yes, it was quite intense, actually. Well, for a start off, when we were put into the platoon sergeants... they were going to make an example of us, and they were going to really frighten us. You know, you've joined the battalion, and that was a bit scary for 2 or 3 days. And then we started training on the Vickers, and that was from, you know, everything basic upwards, really. And those that shone was sort of sorted out into a sort of an order, you know, and thinking in terms of going to career, they'd got to get 9 number ones, 3 range takers, and 3 section sergeants, you know, out of a heap of lads, if you like, you know. So the training was fairly extensive. We did a lot of training from carriers. Leaping.
Now, hang on. Tell me first about how they taught you. What were the skills of firing a Vickers? You know, I mean, what did you have to learn?
Well, the main skills of firing a Vickers were not actually firing it, but how to keep it going. And there were several stoppages that you had certain things.
Do you remember the kind of stoppage that were common and how you'd clear them, roughly speaking? I mean, you might not remember the specifics.
Yeah, you had... actually, it's gone. But one of the ways of clearing was ease pull strike. And that was when you eased the belt and pulled up the lever and then struck it down, and that usually cleared it. And then there was what they called a number two stoppage, which was a separated round in the breech, and you had to use an extractor to get it out. And then in the gun itself, there was what they called a lock. We had to learn how to strip that, put it together, blindfolded, and so you could do it in the dark and stuff like that.
Did you really do it blindfolded? I mean,
yes, he did. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, and you used to put it on a little tray, what I can remember, and like all these bits, and you had to form the body and the seer and all. I can't remember all of it.
The lock's quite complicated, isn't it?
Oh yes, yeah, it was actually. I often wonder if I got the lock now, whether I could strip in and put it back together again. You know, but I think perhaps I could after a while. How the gun was cooled? It was water cooled. What amount of cooling you use? You used to use a fill up the barrel casing with water, and there was an expansion tube from that into a 2 gallon can half full of water, so that as the gun heated up and steamed, it went in. Then you had to refill if you were on a big shoot. And it was quite a weapon.
I mean, would each of you take it in turn as they were looking to complete truth to do all the jobs, or were you being trained for one thing?
Well, what you did, you trained for everything. I mean, the training was general, and then we had a first night shoot.
Now, what was it like to fire? I mean,
the actual gun, quite easy actually. It was on a tripod, a three-legged stand. When we were taught how to put the stand up and how to lock the stand up, which was with clamps, the gun was placed on top, and there was a pin that went through front and rear. There was a wheel for elevation, so that you could turn the wheel to elevate the barrel, and it was a two-handed thing. There were two handles, and there was a lever that you lifted with your forefingers, and you pressed, we used to call pressing the tit, which was the firing mechanism, and the gun used to gently rock. It was very easy.
When you I mean the machine gun battalions, or some of them used to have what they call the 1-inch tap, you know, where they...
Oh, tapping, yes. Well, that was degrees. The tap was
and
a degree.
So you didn't move it, you tapped it to make it side by side.
The only time you moved it was if you were in action, and by becoming up the hill you were on, you'd have free movement, but we never did get to that, to be honest with you. But tapping was...
Can you explain tapping? I know I mentioned it, that's not fair, but can you explain what it was?
Yeah, the gun was locked up, and on the handles, they were wooden handles, and if you said two taps right, you used the heel of your hand on the wooden handle, and you'd hit it twice, right? And that was two taps.
And how far, that would move it about a degree?
A degree. That was roughly a degree each time, yeah.
And that was how you did it?
You'd have a call like, stop firing, two taps right, and carry on, you know, that sort of thing. Or two taps left. Yeah. Yeah.
And it did just go, it seemed to just go a degree from that amount.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the machine gun battalions. I mean, that was in common usage on the Vickers.
Yeah, and I've got to say, after a while, you got a feel for the weapon. If it's a hunter and his gun, he knows his gun backwards. And I think perhaps with machine gunners, it was a bit like that. You know, you knew your own gun.
It was an old gun.
I mean, very old-fashioned, yes. It was in World War One, wasn't it?
World War One, yeah. I think they kept it till the 60s.
Yes.
What was good about it? Why was it?
It was very reliable. You could fire 500 rounds a minute, and you could fire it all night or all day, provided you kept it cool, provided you changed the barrels, which you had to do, and provided it got oil. It would fire all.
So the stoppages, you had to learn them. But
the stoppages were awful, really, because they used to set the gun up, you know, and they just put a cover over it. And the stoppages, you knew by the actual position of the cocking lever. Because as the gun fired, the cocking lever would do this. And if it stopped in a certain place, that's right. If it stopped in a certain place, it would be stoppage number one, two, or three, sort of thing. And they'd set the gun up. and put a duster over it, and then they'd whip it away and say, you've got to stop it, you know, and you had to sort of look at it and work out what it was and then take the action.
But from what you're saying, in real life, if you were firing it, you would not expect to have that many stoppages.
Well, you did have stoppages, yeah.
Oh, you would have them?
Yeah.
But they were quick to clear?
Not always. The worst one was a separated round, when a round itself, the case and the round, separated in the breech. And if the extractor wouldn't work, which sometimes it wouldn't, you had to change the barrel. Now, if you were on a shoot in Korea, they didn't want your gun out of action for long, so you had a barrel already packed.
Now, how did you change the barrel? I mean, was it difficult, or was it...?
It wasn't difficult. I suppose you could change a barrel in less than 5 minutes. Yeah, easily less than 5 minutes. If I knew you got a spare barrel that was cleaned and packed, and when I say packed, there was a groove in the end of the barrel which you packed with asbestos string, and this was to stop water getting back onto the works, you know. Providing that was all done and the barrel went in okay, it was minutes, you know. It was a fairly quick job. Yeah.
Now, so what did each of you in the crew do? I mean, you got the gun firing. The number one would be doing what?
Number one, he was the one in charge, if you like, and he was full corporal.
So he'd basically direct you, would he?
He was directed by the sergeant. Sergeant.
So the sergeant.
Yeah, the number two's job...
The number one would be on the gun.
That's right. Number two's job was to feed in the ammunition. And the number three job was to get the ammunition there and make sure he got water. He was a sort of dog's body, if you like, you know. Yeah.
And what were you mainly at the start? You staff?
Well, when we joined the platoon and we had some training, I enjoyed the training. And then I think one of the sergeants who was training us thought I was shining a bit, so he put me in for a range taker's course, right, which was using a range finder, doing a bit of maths and working out
now
your
ranges. Tell us a bit about it. I don't understand. What was the... Is this about indirect fire and things as well?
No, this was just to get the range from A to B, if you like.
Now, what was the course? Where was that?
That was held within the platoon, and usually by one of the sergeants. And four of us were selected to go on it. And we did this course, which was about a week, I suppose. And they wanted three, and I was unlucky. I didn't get selected.
And what were the skills that they were after? What were you learning?
Well, you had... The range finder was like a T-shaped...
Is it still a bar and Stroud?
Yeah, and you brought the images together, and you took a reading, and you took so many readings, adding them up and divided by whatever, and you got a figure, you know. And that was sort of range finding or range taking. I didn't particularly like that. I wanted to get back on the gun. So I failed, and I was sort of sent back to ordinary training. By this time, we'd sort of been transferred, or we'd moved to Crowborough in Sussex. And we weren't there long... really finish off training and general stuff.
Now, what about indirect fire? Because the thing about the Vickers is it's almost like it's used like the artillery arrows.
Oh, that's right,
You use it to fire on things you can't see. How did they teach you indirect fire?
By using a dial sight.
How did that work? If you know, I mean...
Well, you take up targets. You used to take readings from your dial sight. And then you'd record those readings, and I had an old map case in Korea with all our targets on that we could fire on, and with the dial sight figures. So in the night, and usually it was at night when we fired, you'd put the dial sight on the gun, you had a light in the gun pit. We had a bicycle front lamp at the time. And I covered the glass in with a metal, and I just cut a strip down. And we used to use the dial sight on that. So you put the figures on and dial it up, and you'd know the gun would come round on target. So it was, yeah, this was the way we did it.
Anything else about the vicars you were taught before you went?
Well, we were taught right up until the time we got on the boat, and then we carried on training on the boat.
Were you taught anything about anti-aircraft fire, or were aircraft just too fast then by then for vicars?
There was no question of anti-aircraft fire using the vicars. Not to us, anyway, because I don't think they anticipated seeing much aircraft in Korea, you know.
Now, were you assigned to any particular number, or were you still left?
Well, we were all training, going over on the boat. The number one.
I'll come back to the boat. So before you left, you hadn't been given a number, you know, you weren't number one on the gun or.
No, not at Crowborough. Some of the number ones had been sorted out. If there's any lads that really shone, they were going to be number ones, right? And they were made up to sort of Lance Corporal.
Now, right. So any other types of training you were doing at either Dover or Crowborough? Or was it just machine gun?
No, it was you were in, and that was your job. You
now,
know,
who
you
were the characters in your platoon at the time? I mean, was Haycroft? Was he your?
Yeah, Haycroft was our captain.
He was a captain, was he?
Yeah.
What was he like?
Very fatherly. He was a nice man, very caring man, very quiet but very caring.
And I mean, was he older than or much older?
Well, I suppose at 18, anyone sort of seemed old, you know. I suppose he would be perhaps a man in his 40s or coming up 40, and I'm guessing a bit there because, you know, we had no idea. Then there was three section sergeants.
Was he a good officer? I mean, did he?
Yeah, he was. He was a good officer.
What made him good?
Well, I think he had a lot of understanding. He was a very human man. You had your job to do, but he cared about his platoon, and everyone, I think, respected him, and I think that's really...
Did he know much about machine guns?
Oh, yes, he knew his stuff on machine guns, yeah.
So he wasn't just an officer?
It would appear he did. Having said that, I never did see him fire. I never did see him handle a machine gun, but then... We didn't question that.
But the orders he gave were relevant, you know.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Now, what about your sergeant? Your sergeants.
Well, when we were in Crowborough, we had a couple of sergeants that were coming up for retirement. And they retired, and that's when John Denny got made up to one of the section sergeants.
Now, you know I've met John Denny, but what was John Denny like then as a young sergeant, you know, before you went into action? But what were your first impressions of him?
When I first sort of had anything to do with John, he was a corporal, and I think he came to the battalion after going on a course. And I think he was sort of earmarked then to become a section sergeant. What was he like? He was great, you know. He really was a cut above an ordinary corporal. And one knew, I think, that he was sort of going places, you know.
Then why? What was so good about
him? Then he had qualities that some of the others didn't have, and it's hard to explain, but. Everyone knew that he knew his job, and that was one thing. He knew about machine guns. He was a very fair-minded man, very just. Well, I suppose in the army he was just a good all-round bloke, you know.
So he had a nickname.
Yes, after sort of the boat and the training, we found out what he actually knew. He was labelled as Ace Denny, you know.
He might like that, yes.
Yeah, I don't know whether he knows. I think he knows it now, you know, because I think we told his wife, actually, the last time we knew him as Ace, you know. Then there was Sergeant Warner.
Now, what was he like? Do you know his first name?
Jack. Well, Jack they called him, but, you know, I don't know his other name.
What was he like?
Well, Jack was a regular soldier, and he was all right. But I've got to say that apart from John Denny and our sergeant, who was Sergeant Dockery, I didn't know Sergeant Warner very well, so it's hard to sort of say whether he was a good, bad or whatever bloke, you know. I think his section did a good job, so I suppose that reflects back on him, doesn't it?
And you said Sergeant...
Dockery.
Dockery.
Hmm. Who I believe is now dead, but I'm not sure.
D-O-C-H-E-R...
I'm not sure whether it's D-O-C-H or D-O-C-K-E-R-Y. Tom Dockery.
And what was Tom... I mean, he was your one. I mean, he
well,
was your
Tom had been in the Indian Army as an officer. He came out of the Indian Army and joined the British Army, and he got to sergeant. Now, John was... Tom was an ex-journalist, actually. He was quite a clever man. Quite an academic, actually, Tom Dockery. And he was our section sergeant in Korea. And Jack Warner and John Denny, they were the three.
What was Tom like as your section sergeant in England at first? You know, I mean, how did he strike you?
Very open sort of chap, very friendly, fairly easygoing, not the disciplinarian that John Denny was, but likeable. Likeable. You couldn't help liking him. Sometimes you hated him, but you couldn't help liking him.
Know his stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. He knew his stuff.
Any other characters in your... in your section, any corporals or other NCOs that stood out?
Well, there was Sergeant Dockery, Corporal Churchyard... who recently had a stroke.
Churchyard?
Yeah, Churchyard from Ipswich.
What was he like?
John? Country lad, salt of the earth. Good lad, reliable. Knew the machine gun, good machine gunner. And then...
Any characters amongst the men you met in England? I mean, was there anyone who sort of impressed himself upon you at that time? Any rank, really?
No, not really, I don't think.
Were you aware of people like Bert Fitt? I don't know whether you even knew of him, but I mean...
Fitt? Winky Fitt? Oh, yeah, I knew Winky, but he was a company sergeant major, wasn't he?
Were people like him, the Second World War veterans, did any...
Gilchrist, the RSM, yeah, I mean, everyone knew him. And
well, what did you think of Gilchrist? He's quite a controversial figure, in some way.
Scared to death of him, but he was a good man.
Now tell me about him. Because
well, I'll tell you what happened, a little story, actually. When we were going on embarkation leave, another guy who Corporal Woodhouse from the Assault Pioneers and myself had got to get into the depths of Norfolk on the Friday. And the time that we were going to be allowed out of camp, we would have been sort of stuck in Norwich overnight because of the train problem. So we asked our company sergeant major, who was Tim Chatting, I don't know if you heard of him.
Welcome to him.
If there was any chance that we could leave early to catch an earlier train. And lo and behold, he came up with the answer, yes, we could go early. I just forget the time now, what it was. So we, Corporal Woodhouse and I, went to the station and caught a train to London, and I think we either went to London Bridge or Victoria, and we had to cross over to Liverpool Street.